and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's incitement against the press that is a feature of his rallies, but intensified on Wednesday in Florida, with Trump singling out Katie Turr of NBC News, who the entire crowd turned on. Trump has previously singled her out as Little Katie, a third-rate journalist, riling up the crowd to the extent that the Secret Service had to escort the reporter to her car. Trevor Timm, the executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, who is a U.S. columnist for the U.K. Guardian, joins us to discuss Trump's cynical and dangerous tactic of riling up his crowds, who already hate the press, while falsely accusing the press of not showing the size of the crowds, which they do, and Trump knows it. We'll also speculate on what sort of relationship a President Donald Trump will have with the press, who he often threatens to sue, and whose physical welfare he is now endangering. Then we will speak with a citizen activist, social entrepreneur, and leading millennial voice on sustainability and social impact, who yesterday was shot at point-blank range with a rubber bullet by militarized police live on camera while interviewing peaceful protesters at Standing Rock in North Dakota. Erin Schroeder, who just ran for the U.S. Congress in California's 2nd District, joins us to discuss the escalation of police tactics against the largely Native American protesters, with about 300 police officers deployed along with 100 National Guardsmen, and the double standard, where the heavily armed right-wing Bundy brothers are treated with kid gloves and get charges dropped, but peaceful indigenous people are attacked with dogs and charged with trespassing on their own ancestral lands. Then finally, we will look into the sudden turn of events in the UK, where the High Court ruled that the Parliament will have to vote on whether or not Britain should go ahead and implement the Brexit vote, which narrowly passed in a recent referendum. Harold Clark, a professor in the School of Economic, Political and Policy Studies at the University of Texas, who is the co-investigator of the British Election Study at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor, joins us to discuss how this ruling is likely to split the Conservative Party that is holding on to a slim majority in Parliament and, assuming the Parliament votes to undo the Brexit vote, the gulf between the Parliament and the people will widen even further. And joining us now is Trevor Timm, who is a U.S. columnist with the U.K. Guardian and the executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, a nonprofit that supports and defends journalism dedicated to transparency and accountability. His latest article at The Guardian is James Comey has been abusing his power for years. Welcome to Background Briefing, Trevor Timm.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And just to touch on James Comey, before we talk about what happened yesterday in Florida at one of Trump's rallies, I find it absolutely breathtaking the impact that James Comey's letter has had on this race. Donald Trump himself was in the doldrums. He was despondent. And then suddenly his whole campaign has been revived. There's a spring in his step. The polls are closing. Do you have an explanation for how that one turn of events could have such an impact?
Yeah, it's really been incredible. You know, there is a longstanding policy within the Justice Department and the FBI not to engage in this type of behavior in the weeks and months before the election. But apparently Jim Comey actually went against Department of Justice recommendations and sent this letter to Congress without any further information. You know, the letter was very vague. He had never even read the emails that he was referring to. The emails weren't even to or from Hillary Clinton. And so it was a very bizarre move that, as you said, has upended this race. And it's also opened up a floodgate of other leaks from the FBI, which have been mostly disparaging to Clinton as well. And so I think it's really changed the impetus for this last few days.
My sense is, Trevor Timm, that this is the revenge of the patriarchy. This is like the patriarchy strikes back. There are a bunch of very right-wing Catholics that are in the FBI. They're recruited from Fordham in droves. Many would Opus Dei, like the former head of the Louis Free, etc. And it seems to me that maybe what's going on here with these leaks coming from both Comey and these right-wingers in the FBI, is they simply cannot stand the idea of a woman, a feminist, who is pro-choice becoming president of the United States. I can't think of another explanation for their motives.
Well, there was a story in The Guardian today, actually, talking to a bunch of FBI sources, and one of the sources actually described the inside of the FBI as Trump land, that there are many conservative people inside the FBI that despise Clinton on a personal level. And we know from just pure demographics that the FBI trends very much of the vast majority of the FBI is older white men who are conservative, and that is Donald Trump's base. And so what we're seeing now is really the revenge of those people. Once Comey drafted that letter, it's really opened the floodgates to all of these other stories that have been going on with FBI agents that have an axe to grind.
Well, let's turn, Trevor Tim, to the reason I called you, and that is that yesterday in Florida, Trump incited the crowd against the press. That's been a regular feature. But this time he singled out Katie Turr of NBC News. He'd previously called her Little Katie, a third-rate journalist, and had riled up the crowd to the extent that the Secret Service had to escort Katie Turr to her car. Trump knows that, first of all, that the press do cover the crowds. He knows that perfectly well. So why is he riling up these crowds to basically turn on the press and he says, he points to them. There they are out there, the most disgusting people on the planet. You know, I mean, you've seen the clips. So what explain, is this really, this seems to be a combination of reckless incitement and deep cynicism.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, he has made attacking the press a central tenet of his campaign. You know, there have been polls that have shown that support or trust in the media is at an all-time low, and so he has really attempted to exploit that, not just by calling out reporters in front of hostile crowds and calling them names, but threatening to sue various reporters and news agencies at every turn, talking about how he's going to change the laws when he's president to make it easier to sue newspapers out of existence. As far as freedom of the press goes, there has not been a presidential candidate since Nixon who was both openly campaigned against the press and is a true danger to press freedom.
Well, these people in the crowds at his rallies already hate the press. They have this very, very bedrock belief that there's such a thing as a liberal press. And I can guarantee you that here at Pacifica, which is supposed to be the liberal press, you can't tell me that Pacifica has any influence much in the press anymore. They're going bankrupt, let alone the kind of influence that Fox News has. I mean, this whole thing is a cynical canard to move the goalposts to the right by inventing this straw man of the liberal press. So they've swallowed that clearly whole. But what worries me is that when you have people that have these distorted belief systems, then and many of them are heavily armed, and then you point out the enemy the way that he does. Here they are, and pointing to them penned up in the back of the room. These disgusting people. There's nothing worse than these disgusting people. You know, to me, that's an invitation and to violence.
Absolutely. You know, I think that there is a real worry in the press corps that has been covering Trump that these crowds have been whipped up by Donald Trump, and that oftentimes people are sitting there screaming their heads off with threats to these news media. I mean, luckily, a lot of reporters have thick skin and are used to working in hostile situations. But that doesn't excuse the fact that Donald Trump is basically blaming the media for things that he has said. You know, he threatened to sue the New York Times about 3 weeks ago. And in their response, the New York Times said, "We haven't printed anything that you haven't openly admitted to and said that you are capable of or do." And that's the real thing here, is that Donald Trump is upset that the media is reporting about all of the horrible and disgusting things that he's said in the past. And he just wants to blame the messenger rather than take responsibility for it.
So what kind of a White House will Trump run vis-a-vis the press? I mean, this is insane. It's, I mean, you have to, now that the polls are closing, you have to entertain the appalling specter of this man becoming the next president of the United States. And the consequences, to me, are pretty amazing. His attitude to the press is akin to Putin's and Erdogan's, you know, that they're supposed to be obedient and simply, be stenographers to powerful men. And he obviously can't stand them because even though they've haven't really managed to break through his obdurance and arrogance. For example, he has not given up his or released his tax returns to the public. So arguably he's made a fool of everybody and the press in general. But at the same time, it's pretty clear what his attitudes are by all these threats. You know, he loves them when they give him free media and lavish him with praise, which he seeks. We've heard phone conversations of him pretending to be somebody else in order to butter up the press and get more coverage. But on the other hand, when he's president of the United States, what's he going to do?
Yeah, you know, it's very ironic that it's the press that he bashes day in and day out really created Donald Trump with all of the attention that he got over the past year and a half, especially during the Republican primaries. But actually, I think the best analogy to Trump is Richard Nixon and his old vice president, Spiro Agnew, who in 1968 did much the same thing that Trump is doing now. He was calling out individual reporters during campaign events, whipping up crowds against them. Spiro Agnew actually sued the New York Times in 1968 for libel when they were running for president, much like what Donald Trump has threatened to do many times. And once Nixon got into the White House, he was wiretapping reporters. He was blacklisting them from the press room, much like Donald Trump does with many news outlets at his campaign events. And eventually tried to censor the press during the Pentagon Papers case. And so, you know, I think if we're looking for historical analogies, Richard Nixon is really the perfect one. And that's really what we have to look forward to, unfortunately, if Donald Trump becomes president.
And, of course, Agnew was ended up being the bag man for the mob. And he had to resign. So there we have it. But I do recall, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners do, the famous kind of standoff between Richard Nixon and Dan Rather, where Nixon called out Rather in front of this big crowd, and Rather basically, I can't remember exactly what he said, but he made some kind of remark about perhaps that Nixon was running from the press or something. But in any case, I think your point's well taken. But to my mind, Richard Nixon I would vote for him 1,000 times. I wish he was running. I mean, he was a competent man. He was brilliant on foreign policy. He started the EPA, was extremely progressive on a lot of domestic issues, wanted to start a national health care program. So, you know, we're talking about something seriously different here. This Donald Trump is something that's never happened, and I find it absolutely extraordinary that Donald Trump's campaign is being run out of the Kremlin, and all these patriotic Republicans are going along with it, including Comey, who's sitting on all this information about what the intelligence community and the FBI knows about Russian influence over this election. Talk about a double standard.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the real problem here is that, Comey apparently decided against talking about any of their investigations into Donald Trump before the election, yet went ahead and issued this letter to Congress, which, again, didn't really say much, didn't explain what he knew and what he didn't know, so that people could draw all sorts of crazy and fantastic conclusions about it. And it's really changed the polls at this point. I don't think that anybody could argue that this hasn't upended the race and really given Donald Trump a chance to win, whereas 2 weeks ago it seemed like he had almost no chance at all.
So what's happening then in terms of the, obviously it's not inconceivable that a journalist is going to be beaten up or whatever, you know, suffer some kind of retribution from these mobs. But short of that, you know, they did have his that press spokesperson, Kellyanne Conway, was challenged by Wolf Blitzer the other day on CNN about this. And she said that she talked to Trump and talked to NBC, but wouldn't say what was discussed and what was agreed to. And then, you know, it doesn't seem like anybody can control Trump in any case. What can the Committees to Protect Journalism, et cetera, and your organization, the Freedom of the Press Foundation, what can they do to protect journalists at this point from an angry mob that incited and riled up by Donald Trump?
Well, you know what? It's hard to say. There's nothing that, you know, hopefully the Secret Service is responsible enough to protect any members of the press if violence were to break out. But luckily, when we're talking about things that aren't violent attacks, like Donald Trump's threats to sue the press, which he has done at least a dozen times just during this election, we do have the First Amendment on our side. You know, the reason that Donald Trump hasn't actually followed through with all of these empty threats is because that he knows he would lose. The fact that the First Amendment protects these journalists from publishing or from punishment from publishing all of these stories that look into Donald Trump's past, the report on the women who have accused him of sexual assault, all of this is newsworthy and in the public interest. And thanks to Supreme Court rulings over 50 years ago, we know that they should be protected. So while there's, you know, we can hope that security is beefed up and that cooler heads prevail at these rallies and that these journalists have thick skin to be able to fight through it, we are at least can be content with the fact that if Donald Trump follows through with any of these other threats, these lawsuit threats, that he will be resoundingly defeated.
So would it be reasonable then to assume that if Donald Trump's president, assuming he still has to keep the White House press corps, and I'm sure his first instinct would be to close down the press corps and have them bump them off his plane, the Air Force One. But I guess short of that, what we could perhaps expect is at the press conferences, Trump will, you know, since Breitbart's Bannon is his right-hand man now, he will go to Breitbart News, O'Reilly, Hannity, and Brett Baer, by the way. Brett Baer is the Fox News guy that's leaking all of this right-wing, Hillary-hating stuff coming from these FBI people who have tried to torpedo Hillary Clinton's election chances. So is that a possibility that we'll simply just have this hilariously stacked? Because he doesn't – Trump himself now will not talk to any reporter except basically Hannity.
I mean, this was a favorite tactic of the George Bush administration. Only go to friendly media, media that's already conservative and isn't going to ask you tough questions. And I would almost guarantee that Trump would follow suit. But we have to remember that Trump is very narcissistic and craves attention. And despite the fact that he trashes all these media organizations, I'm sure he won't be able to resist going on all these shows. And given that he will have even more power as president to be able to control the news, you know, there's no telling what he can do when he's in that office.
And is there any way that the press, you know, because if this guy becomes president, you know, there'll be a lot of blame all around for how did this happen. And a part of the blame has to be assigned to the press because, you know, they've enabled him with billions of dollars worth of free media. They haven't sufficiently, I think, been able to get through to the American people who this guy really is. Now, maybe the people that support Trump are so alienated from the press that they already hate, as we discussed earlier, that there's no getting through. But I don't think that you can make the case. I mean, if Trump becomes president, then my sense is that there's plenty of blame to be assigned, some of which should be directed at the press.
I think as far as blame to the press goes, I think we have to look at two different aspects of the press. One, there's cable television, and then the other, there are the newspapers and the internet journalism sites, which have been doing drastically different types of work about Trump. The newspapers, including the New York Times and the Washington Post, have been doing incredible investigative journalism, exposing Trump from every angle. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. that journalism has not translated at all to television, where a lot more people get their news. And, you know, CNN, for example, and Fox News, and all of the other cable television channels have really treated Trump with very soft gloves, at least for the first 6 months, and really helped his meteoric rise because he was getting all of this free media. And I certainly think if Trump were to win, those cable news stations would take a lot of the blame.
Well, Trevor Temer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And again, I'm speaking with Trevor Temer, who's a U.S. columnist with the UK Guardian and the executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, a nonprofit that supports and defends journalism dedicated to transparency and accountability. His latest article at The Guardian is James Comey has been abusing his powers for years. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with an activist who was shot at point-blank range yesterday with a rubber bullet by militarized police live on camera while interviewing peaceful protesters at Standing Rock in North Dakota.
Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be double.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Erin Schrode, who is a citizen activist, social entrepreneur, and leading millennial voice on sustainability and social impact, a community organizer and vocal advocate for environmental action, public health, and equal justice. She just ran for the United States Congress in California's 2nd District, and yesterday, Erin Schrode was shot by militarized police live on camera while interviewing peaceful protesters at Standing Rock in North Dakota. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erin Schrode.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Erin, are you still feeling, I mean, being shot at point-blank range by a rubber bullet is nevertheless pretty violent and pretty painful, isn't it?
Oh, yes. It's startling. It's painful. I woke up this morning feeling it more than last night. And I'll tell you, when I had that realization this morning that I may have the footage, I may have been taping live when I was shot, that reliving the horror added a whole other level of pain and depth.
So what's happening here with this escalation on the part of law enforcement, where they've deployed 300 police officers along with 100 National Guardsmen? What's going on?
I wish I understood. I wish I could justify that sort of militarized force in response to unarmed, peaceful prayer for people. But I can't. I cannot fathom why they are sending so many authorities. I cannot fathom why they are wielding assault rifles, pepper spray, mace. It seems entirely unjustifiable to me.
Well, of course, just in the broadest sense, it's an extraordinary thing, though, to watch. We recently witnessed this extraordinary event in with this militia, heavily armed right-wing militia people up in Oregon, got exonerated. They were treated with kid gloves all along by the federal government. They kept at their distance, even though they were effectively domestic terrorists who took over federal buildings, heavily armed with assault rifles. They were treated with kid gloves, and then in the trial, their charges were dropped. Meanwhile, in North Dakota, indigenous people are physically attacked by dogs, and charged with trespassing on their own ancestral lands.
Yeah, and we're seeing it even right here with the pipeline. This pipeline's also set to go through Iowa. And you have farmers and ranchers protesting there. Some of them were arrested, but no one was treated the way that these Native Americans are being treated, thrown into dog kennels, chain-linked mesh fences, having their sacred objects desecrated and destroyed, having their burial grounds upended for the construction of this pipeline. It is racism, it is environmental racism, it is violations of human justice and human rights.
So I mentioned that you ran for Congress in the 2nd District. That's Marin, isn't it, in Northern California?
Yeah, from the Golden Gate to the Argonne border. I'm born and raised in Marin County.
I see. And so is that Nancy Pelosi's seat?
No, it's Jared Huffman is the incumbent.
Oh, okay, okay.
San Francisco.
Right. And how did you do?
We launched the campaign 70 days prior to the primary election. I'm not a politician. I'm the first to tell you that. But for me, in the election, we came up 6.6 points short of second place. And California has an open primary, so our goal was second there. We got 21,000 votes, which is better than anyone ever thought. But I was realistic going into it about my chances of, quote, you know, of winning, and I'm not going to be that millennial that says, you know, we're all winners, but...
you didn't get your trophy? Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, right. Like, boo-hoo. But no, really, it was about redefining civic engagement and reinvigorating this culture of public service while expanding the definition of who can be a politician. So I'm incredibly proud of what we did, the way we were able to coalesce, organize people on the ground around issues. It's around the issues that matter, fighting for environmental and public health, human rights were key pillars of our campaign. It's why I'm here. It's what I live and breathe every day.
Well, but this is very gratifying to hear because you're both an activist and somebody that hasn't, become alienated from the political process, which unfortunately is the case with many activists, that they they just don't expect to win. They don't see themselves as a part of the American process, that the government is captured and alien, whereas my argument has always been that if a group of the far right Tea Party people can take over the Republican Party, I don't see why progressive activists can't take over the Democratic Party.
I would love to see progressive activists take over the Democratic Party. I think that is what we are all hoping to do with each other under a Hillary Clinton presidency on November 9th. It's about really keeping the momentum of this revolution that we've started going, carrying it forward. You've seen so many people get involved in this election cycle, and I think it's quite ironic that a 75-year-old white man was the one who excited so many. But now you do have people seeing that there's a place for all of us in politics, that policy does affect our daily lives. So while we organize on the streets and on reservations, while we push for corporate change, from through our consumer power and as employees and within companies, and we use social and digital media, we also can't forget about the policy arena. We cannot turn a blind eye on government. We got to get involved.
Well, what you're doing now there at Standing Rock in North Dakota, it's almost like, my God, it's we've gone back to that ugly period in American history. When the colonists basically committed genocide against the Native Americans, the indigenous people.
Oh, absolutely.
And then over the centuries and decades since, of course, the deals and treaties have always been broken. And this feels like a revisiting of this what's happening now. What's the sense amongst the Native Americans there that does this – I know that they're absolutely determined – but is this a part of that ugly history that we have here in the United States?
Absolutely. This is bringing back that historic trauma of the killings, of the removals, of the forced boarding schools, of every massacre since Columbus to the present day. And instead of people, you know, flipping open teepees with their bare hands, they're doing it with the tips of assault rifles. And make no mistake that this is not just an environmental crisis or a human rights crisis. This is racist as well. So when you layer that on, I mean, I feel the pain. I am incensed, but I don't have the compounding of this historic trauma and the literally every single moment in history when things could have gone wrong, been against these Native Americans. It has. And it's injustice after injustice, and here they are facing it once again. And I'm proud to be here standing alongside in solidarity, but I do not purport to share in that history of horrific oppression.
And again, I'm speaking with Erin Schroeder, who's a citizen activist, social entrepreneur, and leading millennial voice on sustainability and social impact, a community organizer and vocal advocate for environmental action, public health, and equal justice. She ran for the United States Congress in California's 2nd District, and yesterday Erin Schroeder was shot by militarized police live on camera while interviewing peaceful protesters at Standing Rock in North Dakota. But the militarization, the escalation of police and National Guardsmen would indicate to me that the governor and the government in North, state government in North Dakota, along with the Access Pipeline people and their goons, because we already saw that earlier stuff that Amy Goodman captured on film of the dogs being unleashed on Native American protesters. It seems as if, just as President Obama is saying that he's in negotiation with the Army Corps of Engineers to reroute the pipeline, it looks as if they're trying to create facts on the ground. Is that what's happening?
They're trying to create what on the ground, pardon me?
Facts on the ground. In other words, they're just forging ahead while there are discussions going on that perhaps this whole idea is a bad one and maybe there's another way to reroute the pipeline. And in other words, the pipeline people, along with the government, the police, and the National Guard, they're just moving as fast as they can.
They are. And we saw this back in September when they began to jump 20 miles ahead to force this work when there was a discovery, a statement about the fact that this was indeed sacred burial ground. You see it now. They're working 24/7. There are unbelievably obnoxious light stanchions that are always there. You hear the tools. You hear the planes flying above. And you also see, so right now, they're working towards the Army Corps of Engineer land, which is about 400 meters on either side of the river. And they are not allowed to drill or dig there without a permit. They do not have that permit. That requires congressional approval. I don't believe that they will stop at that 400 meters. I don't believe that they will listen to the letter of the law. What is preventing them from drilling further? That's why we have to take action as the people, as holding our government accountable and ensuring that we do everything we can to legally and politically stop them. But honestly, I don't think anything will stop them.
So let's assume that the Army Corps of Engineers, under pressure from the president, decide to reroute it. How are they going to cross that river?
If they decide to reroute
it? Can you reroute it and not cross the Missouri River?
It was supposed to go through a predominantly white area near Bismarck.
Uh-huh.
They fought it. So this is now where it's going.
Right.
I come from an environmental background. Let me tell you a little bit about what it means to put in a pipeline. This has such a high risk of a leak, of a breach, that would contaminate the drinking water of a downstream watershed of over 17 million people. In the year 2012 alone, on-share spills amounted to 15.6 million gallons of oil, of wastewater, of fracking fluid. And, I mean, that's 5 million more than the Exxon Valdez oil spill catastrophe in its entirety. And we see thousands of incidents of liquefied natural gas, of crude oil leaks, of ruptures that cause billions of dollars in damages, not to mention the death and the injuries and the toxic pollution that will affect future generations. So, yes, we are fighting the pipeline right now with the Standing Rock Nation, but rerouting this does not eliminate that risk of contamination. And the Bakken oil shale is a disaster. This is fracked oil that is being transported west. And when we create these pipelines, then we incentivize this demand, incentivize this drilling and this fracking. It's a mess. And there are ways that we can power our nation, that we can power our world through renewable energy and keep our fossil fuels in the ground.
So, in other words, you don't think that there is a workable compromise here, that the president and the Army Corps of Engineers are working on. The pipeline should be stopped as opposed to rerouted. Is that what you're telling us?
I believe the pipeline should be stopped. But hearing President Obama say that he will let it play out for the next couple of weeks while considering whether or not to reroute it doesn't suffice. They need to come in right now and stop this destruction and degradation and human rights violations here on the land, but then they need to halt this pipeline altogether.
Well, I saw, in fact, I interviewed somebody a while back about the financing behind it, and it's just this huge conglomeration of both American banks, including people like Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, I think, is also one of them, and foreign banks as well. I think it's about, we're talking about $4 billion. So that's clearly a part of the momentum, right? You've got big bucks, right? Big bucks and little people who's been screwed for centuries and decades, and they're fighting back. So it's therein is the battle line, right?
Oh, yeah. The tracing of the money is always an interesting and dirty game, but there's a lot of money invested in this, and we need to stop it. They say that they need to get it done on a heightened time frame for the sake of the investors. We've heard December 1st, we've heard January 1st, we've heard Q1 2017. Let's just stop it altogether and try to find more sustainable, renewable ways to power our country, to power industry, to create jobs. We know that we can do it, but do we have the will? Do we have the political will? We need to pressure people.
Well, so given that this talk of compromise and you and the Standing Rock Nations and the Indigenous peoples are going to continue to make a stand, I take it that there's no to your mind, there is no compromise, that rerouting this, the real issue is that this, it's just like the tar sands from Canada. This simply should not happen in the first place, and it should be stopped as soon as possible. Is that your position?
Yes, it is. But first and foremost, it needs to stop. I mean, where is the Department of Justice right now with these human rights violations? That needs to stop first. Pause the building of the pipeline right now, and then we can ensuring it's not constructed altogether. This isn't just a fight about this pipeline. This is about every pipeline that is being built across the United States of America right now that is carrying dirty oil, crude oil, that is posing threats to millions and millions and millions of people's water supplies, and going through land where it absolutely does not belong. It's about eminent domain for private gain. It's about illegal land seizures. There are so many issues wrapped up in this one pipeline that we need to ensure that it's halted, both for the sake of these people, for the sake of our health, and for the sake of precedence.
Well, Erin Schrody, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Erin Schrody, who's a citizen activist, social entrepreneur, and leading millennial voice on sustainability and social impact, a community organizer and vocal advocate for environmental action, public health, and equal justice. She just ran for the United States Congress in California's 2nd District. And yesterday, Erin Schrody was shot by militarized police live on camera while interviewing peaceful protesters at Standing Rock in North Dakota, where she joined us from. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the sudden turn of events in the UK, where the High Court ruled that the Parliament will have to vote on whether or not Britain should go ahead and implement the Brexit vote.
Thank you. Nung isilang ka sa mundong ito, laking tuwa ng magulang mo at ang kamay nilang iyong ilaw. At ang nanay at tatay mo'y di malaman ang gagawin.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Harold Clark, a professor in the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He has been the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. He is the author of Affluence, Austerity, and Electoral Change in Britain, and his latest book is Austerity and Political Choice in Britain. And he has a new book coming out soon, Brexit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harold Clark.
Hello, Ian. It's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you again, Harold. And this time, we've already had the extraordinary Brexit vote, and here we are in the United States holding our breath to see whether next Tuesday there'll be Brexit times 1,000 if Donald Trump becomes president.
Exactly.
So aware of these uncertainties and unpredictabilities, now the Brexit story in the UK has had another twist and turn. The High Court in the UK dealt a blow to the UK's Brexit plans by basically saying that there's no way that they can initiate the process to leave the European Union without a vote from Parliament. So now it's been thrown back at the Parliament, and is there a possibility that the Parliament could in fact negate the Brexit vote?
Yes, there's sort of two dimensions to this, Ian. The first is the constitutional dimension, and of course, with the British tradition of parliamentary supremacy, which is centuries old and enshrined in the British Constitution. The idea of having referendums to make major political decisions like Brexit, of course, sits very uneasily with these sort of hallowed principles. And so I think that we're headed sort of for what we might call a constitutional showdown here. The other dimension is the party political. And as we know and have seen with the Brexit vote and with other events over the last several years, the governing Conservative Party is deeply divided between the Europhiles and the Eurosceptics. So there's a possibility that we would see an open split in the Conservative Party. A really historic kind of thing could occur and the reconfiguration of the British party system.
But it would seem, though, on the surface, that the numbers are there to vote against Brexit, with Labour and Scottish Nationalists and half of the Tories, or whatever the percentage is between the Eurosceptics and the Europhiles.
Yeah, I think that would be my guess as well. However, the very fact of having that vote over an issue like Brexit, given the heated campaign and the deep devotion of the Eurosceptics to in the Conservative Party to leaving the EU, I think, would be what would precipitate a split, and that these people might well decide to leave the party.
So this suit was brought about by several plaintiffs. Who were they?
Well, I don't know exactly who they are, I must say, Ian. It seems like a natural thing to do, though, and as I say, it fits so well with British constitutional principles. So I don't know who the actual plaintiffs were in this.
But the point you're making is that the case that they brought forth basically has essentially the precedent of the supremacy of the Parliament, right?
It does. And essentially this is like a core principle in British constitutional theory and practice. So in retrospect, it's sort of a natural thing to do, and had a very good prospect of being successful, which it was.
So it's kind of the opposite of California, where the state of California does almost everything by referendum.
Exactly.
I take it referenda are fairly uncommon in the UK.
Well, they're very, very uncommon in the UK, and this is only the third national referendum that's been held. We've had two on Brexit, one in 1975, and of course this one on June 23rd this year, and then there was one on changing the electoral system to from first past the post to what's called the alternative vote system in 2011. So there, you know, this is the anti-California, if you will, when it comes to popular involvement in making big decisions.
And then we're talking about the High Court ruling delivering a blow to the Conservative government in the UK's Brexit plans. I mean, the fact that the Prime Minister, Theresa May, sort of went ahead, gritted her teeth. I think she's a Europhile, isn't she?
Well, I think she probably is not, in fact.
Okay.
She'd be a very, a sort of closet Eurosceptic.
Uh-huh.
But she's very politically astute.
Right.
And rather famous for not saying anything, and when she does say something, of not saying anything. And
right.
She says Brexit means Brexit, but again, what does Brexit mean? And so, no, she's been very canny throughout this, but this is going to really force her hand. This is going to make it much more difficult for her.
Well, I was going to say that the fact that she put Boris Johnson, who is a main proponent of Brexit, along with the right-wing Nigel Farage, who's been campaigning with Donald Trump and who's a part of Vladimir Putin's RT stable, that she put Boris Johnson as foreign secretary, the way that I saw it was, this was his punishment.
Well, I think that you may well be correct there, Ian. And you know, the old principle, better to have them in the tent going outside rather than vice versa, I think was in play as well.
So talk about then what this might do to the British parliamentary system, because it's changed so much so quickly. You know, you had that duopoly of the Labour and Conservatives ruling for decades. The Liberals for a while had a little bit of traction, but they haven't really been that significant. And then all of a sudden, one of the major parties, the Labour Party, is all but wiped out. And they've had leadership struggles.
Indeed.
So now you've got the Labour Party with a split down the middle with the pro-Corbyn and the anti-Corbyn Labourites.
Yeah.
And now it seems like the same thing's happening to the Conservative Party. It's split between the Eurosceptics and the Europhiles.
That's right. We already, of course, have had effectively a split in the Conservative Party with the growth of UKIP and its success in the 2014 European elections. When it came first, it was the first time in over 100 years that a party other than Labour or the Conservatives had come first in a British national election. Overall, the analyses we've done have shown that, you know, there's a huge change in the British party system already in terms of popular support for the two traditional parties. And as I said a little bit ago, that indeed this latest court ruling is exactly the kind of lever that might divide a Conservative Party right down the middle.
But I recall, though, after the Brexit vote, which surprised everybody, and particularly the polls,
there was
a certain sort of hangover where a lot of people were saying, oh, well, I didn't really mean this, you know. And there was talk of a sort of re-vote. So how real is that? In other words, now that the court has forced the situation back where the parliament's going to take a vote, will the people not be that necessarily unhappy if they voted to sort of close the door and just pretend this whole thing was a big mistake?
Well, one sort of piece of evidence that's interesting is we did a national survey a few weeks ago and found that in the aggregate, at least, the percentage of people, you know, attitudes towards the European Union were almost identical to what they had been on June 23rd. So this idea of Brexit remorse has been discussed in the press, as you point out, but it really doesn't seem that there's a lot of evidence for it in public opinion. So if they were to go ahead and have yet another Brexit vote, which I doubt would happen, but if they did, I think it again would be a very closely fought thing.
So that means that we could have a split in not just between in within the parties themselves, but where the parliament is voting one way and the British people are voting another.
Exactly, exactly. And this, you know, just I think dramatically illustrates the gulf really between the you know elite group you know class broadly defined, the sort of Westminster bubble, if you will, to use a British term. And the rest of the country.
So I imagine, you know, when you just mentioned Howard Clarke, that the attitudes to the British attitudes to the EU haven't changed, and there's still a majority in the UK who don't want to be part of the Brussels. What just happened in with the Canadian trade deal with the EU, which got held up at the last minute by a province in Belgium, Wallonia? Where the government of Belgium had and all the other EU members had signed on to this trade deal with the Canadians, but this one little part of Belgium, which itself is a pretty small country, was holding up the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I must say, on the surface, I thought to myself, well, boy, this really does give ammunition to the idea that, you know, the EU governance structure is dysfunctional.
Oh, I think it is. And another illustration, you know, that maybe on the horizon of this has to do with what would happen if Scotland were to leave the United Kingdom and apply, as it certainly would immediately, to join the EU. Spain has already indicated quite clearly that they would never allow Scotland to join the EU, of course, trying to head off separatists in Catalonia. And you might find the same thing with in Italy with the Northern League and so forth. And so this idea, you know, the EU basically has this idea of a, what we call a Polish veto. It just takes one player to, however big or however small, to upset deals. And indeed, that's the Canadian situation is a good example of that.
But currently, in terms of Theresa May, and you say that she's sort of a skilled politician who is not clear about whether she's a Eurosceptic or a Europhile, and she keeps holds her cards pretty close.
She does.
But currently, the Conservative Party have a slim majority with 329 seats in the 650-seat UK
Indeed.
Parliament. So she's already on a bit of a razor's edge there.
That's right. It's a very she's very much a hostage to small groups within her party already, and this is exactly the kind of issue that could spin things out of control for her.
So what's likely to happen then? They're going to go ahead with the vote. The people will be weighing in already. Nigel Farage is weighing in, warning about a half Brexit, which, you know, they've been arguing that they've been slow walking this thing in any case.
Yes, that's right. They have.
So this sounds like a recipe for political turmoil in the UK.
Oh, undoubtedly. I suspect that she's going to try to press ahead with a sort of soft Brexit deal now. But whether or not that would be acceptable to the Eurosceptics in her party, you know, it's very, you know, it is doubtful. And so, you know, I've argued all along that the sort of default position in this game between the UK and Europe is a hard Brexit. And, of course, this is, you know, really throws a monkey wrench into the whole thing. And so we just don't know, Ian. I mean, these are uncharted waters and very small groups of people, like you just suggested, when you talk about how small her minority or majority is, and she's very close to being a minority in Parliament, she's going to be hostage to just sort of the whims of small groups, little cabals in her party. And so who knows what's going to happen.
But going back to the ruling from the High Court that's basically forced the Parliament to get into the Brexit business and take a vote, the Lord Chief Justice John Thomas said that, quote, the most fundamental rule of the UK Constitution is that Parliament is sovereign and can make or unmake any law it chooses. Now, what I find ironic about that is that's exactly the case that the supporters of Brexit made, arguing that only by leaving the European Union could Parliament sovereignty be completely restored.
Indeed, indeed. Here, and so we restore British sovereignty. But, of course, British sovereignty basically means parliamentary rule. And so there is, as you point out, an irony there. But it's going to be a pretty cruel one, I think, for Theresa May.
So, but is this, as is the case here in the United States, the difference, one of the many differences between the Trump supporters and the Clinton supporters are, and as Trump himself has says, I love the poorly educated voters, is you do have a kind of, you have the same kind of anger. You talked about the populist anger against the elites that have failed people, and there's no questioning that truth. But on the other hand, it's just mind-boggling to think that somebody so manifestly unqualified and so deeply shallow could be president of the United States, and it seems like he's getting close to that.
I agree with everything you said, and it is noteworthy that he is now within striking distance of winning this election.
But again, you go back to the dichotomy between the relatively educated people and the relatively uneducated people voting,
sure.
And that's what the line that split you, because I always assumed that the British people were fairly well educated, and they were, after all, right there in Europe, whether they liked it or not. So that they're sort of cosmopolitan, international. You remember, they used to have an empire.
Sure.
They used to have an empire. So
indeed,
so
indeed.
They,
no, I was very surprised by the Brexit decision. In the end, I could see it coming scientifically, but nevertheless, it is surprising for the reasons that you said. You're absolutely right as well to point out the deep division across social classes and educational groups in the UK for the Brexit decision. And, of course, you can see exactly the same thing when you look at the public opinion polls with regard to support for Clinton and Trump.
Well, Harold Clark, I'll be in touch again, I think.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Ian, and we're doing a couple of big surveys here in the U.S. We have one on the field now. We'll have another one right after the day after the election. So, you know, I'd be happy to chat with you about how things come down.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Harold Clark, who's a professor in the School of Economic, Political, and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He has been the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. He is the author of Affluence, Austerity, and Electoral Change in the UK, and his latest book is Austerity and Political Choice in Britain. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.